From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. After the lead and water crisis in Flint, Michigan, questions arose everywhere, including here in Pittsburgh. What about our water?
I've been trying to run the water enough so that there's not supposed to be any lead particles in it, but the fact that it's coming through that lead line is still troublesome.
Today, 90.5 WESA and its media partners conclude a two-week series by looking at possible solutions to the lead problems. Also, Uber autonomous vehicles return to Pittsburgh streets after about a 72-hour absence following an accident in Arizona. Some people question the safety of the vehicles.
I think this gets at a lack of studies on what consumers want out of self-driving cars and consumer perception of self-driving cars. I think this is all too new for people to really grasp until you're next to one.
Plus, we'll take a look at how media covers diversity. All that on The Confluence after this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Uber's self-driving cars are back on the streets of Pittsburgh after being pulled for 72 hours following an accident in Arizona. Do people have safety concerns sharing the roads with those vehicles? Plus, we're going to explore how Pittsburgh media covers diversity in our community. But first, today, 90.5 WESA and our public media partners, Allegheny Front, Public Source, and Keystone Crossroads, are wrapping up a two-week reporting project, Hidden Poison. We're talking about Pittsburgh's troubling history of lead. If you have a question or comment, tweet us. Use hashtag WESA Confluence. Before we get started on wrapping up and looking at solutions that our reporters explored to the lead issues, I want to introduce Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads reporter for WESA, and also Kara Holsoppel is host and producer for Allegheny Front's weekly program that airs on WESA. Margaret, as I said, before we get into some of the solutions that you've explored in your stories, you just came back from a lot of news that's happening around the PWSA and water today. So what's happening briefly?
Sure. So at 9 a.m., Councilwoman Darlene Harris held a press conference that said she had a lot of unanswered questions about board members as well as PWSA in general. At 10 o'clock, there was a public meeting that Mayor Bill Peduto, along with an advisory panel, are interviewing finalists for a restructuring team to look at how best to help the PWSA operate in a way that addresses capital investment problems, servicing the debt, and making a water system that, as they say, will work for Pittsburghers 40 years, 100 years into the future.
Okay. And were there people there rallying for, quote, public water?
Yes. So council chambers were full. There were a lot of people who were looking forward to the public comment section that will come after or came after the presentations by these finalists. And I got to speak with one gentleman beforehand, but the idea is people are really nervous about the idea of privatization. Mayor Bill Peduto, as well as his chief of staff, Kevin Ackland, emphasized they're not looking at privatization as an option.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, let's get into the conclusion of this two-week project. As Kara and Margaret, as you were digging into your particular stories, researching, was there anything, whether it reflected directly on the story that you were exploring or just the lead issue in general, that sort of piqued your interest? We'll start with you, Kara.
Well, I think that as I was, my story is about lead in soil.
Right.
And so, you know, I guess what surprised me most is how pervasive a problem it is. I've been an environment reporter. I'm an environmental reporter for a few years, and which makes you kind of a mini expert on certain topics that you're actually reporting on. But I didn't have the full scope of how much exposure a person, a child, could be getting from lead from the different sources, from water, of course. We talked a lot about water, from paint in house, and also from the soil. I didn't realize how big a problem it was.
Okay. Margaret, anything that, you know, as you were doing, you did a couple of stories for this series, anything that sort of you said wow about or that piqued your interest?
I think I looked a lot at the water infrastructure, and I think just what struck me is how big of an issue money is, which of course so many issues in the world are related to money, but the PWSA board had been considering some sort of filter plan for months before the mayor and partners announced the Safe Water Plan. But the biggest issue, Chief of Staff Kevin Ackland told me, is just the available funds. And so I just think a lot of this comes down to debt structure, revenue, and money.
All right. So this week, your stories and the stories of your colleagues from Public Source and also from WESA, we're talking about solutions after outlining some of the issues, challenges, problems, if you want to call them, in the first week of this series. For water, I mean, we're talking immediate actions such as flushing and filtering that you alluded to, Margaret, and then something a longer-term process, lead line replacements. Replacing private lines from curb to home, curb to residence, that's the sticky part. Bring us back up to date, Margaret, on why it's sticky as far as who can do it, who can pay for it, or who has to pay for it right now.
Sure. So that two parts of the lead service line are important because right now under the Municipal Authorities Act, PWSA cannot go past the curb to replace someone's lead line. It's just they're not allowed to spend taxpayer money basically on private improvements.
Okay. So now does this apply to all municipalities?
No. So this is where it gets tricky, and I've read the law, but not in a way that I think I'm an expert in any sense.
Okay, but it definitely affects Pittsburgh and more.
It affects Pittsburgh. It affects Philadelphia. Philadelphia got an exception to the law to allow them to rip out private lines. And one thing that was brought up in this meeting today I'd like to add is that ripping out that portion of the service line from the curb to that runs into a homeowner's residence is just the beginning. If there's lead piping in the home, there's nothing. There's still going to be lead in that water.
Okay. Now, something new happened this week regarding that challenge because replacing the private lines can be quite costly. Senator Wayne Fontana from Allegheny County has proposed three different bills, and one would allow, in this case, the PWSA to replace those private lines from curb into residence. And also part of the PennVest, funding for infrastructure could be used to help ease the cost, ease the financial impact on homeowners. So that's at least, I mean, it still has to go through the legislature, but that's still a step forward for homeowners, though.
It is, and the URA had voted on a private loan program to help low-income homeowners to cover this cost. A gentleman I spoke with pointed out, though, that if you're a homeowner who can afford it, it's going to be an expense, but you are the homeowner, and just as you would replace your hot water heater or whatever, it's your responsibility.
And we're talking thousands of dollars usually.
Yes.
It varies, obviously. Okay. Now, we've been talking a lot, and I think a great deal of attention since Flint has been on lead in water.
And rightly so.
Yeah. But, Kara, you found out, as you said, and being an environmental reporter, seems like maybe you were even surprised at the extent of the lead elsewhere, in particular in soil, or not?
Yeah, well, you know, when we're talking about water, we're talking about homeowners having some responsibility for this, but a lot of people think about water as a public service. We pay for water. We expect clean water, rightly so. When it comes to lead, it's a little bit different. Lead is a toxin that's in our soil, and it's a legacy pollutant.
So how'd it get there?
Well, some lead is there naturally. In Pennsylvania, like there could be up to 50 parts per million. This sort of occurs in the soil. It's like what they call background level.
Okay.
And then the rest of it got there from the paint on houses, whether houses were when the houses were knocked down, for some reason in Pittsburgh, they were kind of just like implode them into the ground. There could be house paint from the outside. So before 1978, there was lead in paint. And then there was leaded gasoline until the 1990s. So those are two sources. And
so is this spilled gasoline that got into it or gets emissions
in
the air?
It's from the air. Exactly. It's from emissions from, you know, years and years and years. And the thing about lead is I've talked to a lot of geologists about this. They have described it as sticky. It has a positive charge, and it likes to partner with organic matter in the soil that has a negative charge. And so it kind of just accumulates in the soil. It sort of grabs on, accumulates in the soil over years and years and years, and it never goes anywhere. It doesn't sink into the groundwater. It's not washed away by rain, and it's just sort of waiting there for us. And so when we talk about solutions, really the main solution for most people, especially gardeners or people who spend a lot of time outside in their yards, is to manage the risk.
Okay. So you've been finding out what people are doing to test, and you talked with a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Burgess about testing soil and readings, and Jonathan is with the Allegheny County Conservation District.
Nothing that screams, off the charts dangerous. It tends to be, kind of middle levels, like between, say, 200 and 1,000. And across that range, you could simply have wash your hands, wash your vegetables. And at the upper end, it's more keep your kids out of there.
Yeah, that was Jonathan Burgess of the Allegheny County Conservation District, as you mentioned, Kevin. And he they're doing free lead screenings all over the city of Pittsburgh. They're going to do another one on April 8th in the Hill District. And it's for home gardeners, community gardeners, anybody who wants to get a sample of their soil tested to see if it has lead in it.
Okay. So first, Margaret, then Kara. We've been hearing numbers about federal action levels when it comes to water. And then how does that compare to numbers that we should be concerned about in the soil? Margaret, what are those action numbers again?
The federal action limit is 15 parts per billion.
And Pittsburgh's has gone down, I believe, since June when it was more than 20-some, but it's gone down a little bit in the December readings, but it's still above 15. So what are the numbers of normal, if we would, start to be concerned?
Yeah.
What's that range, Kara, for soil?
It's actually different depending on the part of the country that you live in. California's levels are much lower, what they think of as safe. Here, we talked about a lead level in soil at 150 parts per million. And that would be safe for most gardeners to just go ahead and plant in the soil that they have in their backyard or wherever they're having their garden. You can plant leafy greens and vegetables in that kind of soil. It's safe to do that because leafy greens can actually pull up lead into the leaves and contaminate the leaves. And, of course, they're also very close to the ground, so they could be exposed if they're not washed properly to lead in the soil that way.
But are they safe to eat then, though?
If you're growing in that lower level,
right. You mentioned
absolutely,
the leafy green vegetables.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, when you get to, and these are, EPA has recommendations for this. So when you get to about 400 parts per million, that's where the concerns start to happen. They call that like a medium level of lead. In that case, they recommend that people grow, if they want to grow vegetables in their backyard or space,
right.
If they use raised beds. So you would, build a bed, create a barrier between the soil and bring in soil to grow, especially those leafy greens and root vegetables. If you grow, it doesn't seem like lead, from the studies that I've looked at and people I talk to, doesn't seem like lead breaks through what they call the fruit barrier. So if you have fruiting plants like tomatoes, it's not going to be taken up into the fruit itself. But if a tomato were to fall in the ground where there were a higher level of lead, you wouldn't want to make sure you wash it off. Same thing with, if you're playing out in the garden, you wouldn't want to make sure you wash your hands if you have sort of a lower to medium, lead level in your over 1,000. That's where they say forget it. Don't even disturb the soil. Don't let your kids play out there. Those are kind of the.
All right.
It's a gradient, and
right.
What I mean by manage risk is you can sort of make decisions. Once you know what the level is, you can make decisions about who should be interacting with the soil and how.
Okay. We're talking about lead in our water, lead in soil. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're joined by Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads reporter for WESA, and Kara Holsoppel, producer host for Allegheny Front. So I want to bring this back to both water and soil and the solutions that can be done. Margaret, you spoke with Morgan O'Brien, president and CEO of People's Gas, right? He seemed to think that this issue, he sort of had a broad perspective, has wider implications than, I would say, not minimizing individual health or anything, but this has implications for the region.
Everybody's read the story about Flint, Michigan. And I always pictured, you know, if you were a community leader in Flint and you were trying to draw business to come there and create jobs, if you were trying to help companies grow there, all those efforts probably came to a dead halt.
Okay, so am I right when you say looking at this has an impact on the region, not just on public health, but on the future vitality of the region? Even.
Sure, the viability of the region, I think. And Mayor Bill Peduto emphasized that himself today in this public meeting. He said, if a city can't provide safe drinking water, a city can't survive. So, yeah, I think there's this greater concern that not only are people's health at risk or potential risk, but our ability as a region to continue adding people, continue adding business, and be a city that works.
And he mentioned that we got this wonderful resource, our rivers, and what good is it if it's the water from the rivers isn't safe?
Pittsburgh has abundant water, but if you can't pump water from the rivers, if you can't filter it and provide it to people, then it's sort of useless.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left, and so I want to summarize some of the solutions, Margaret. Short term and long term with water, and some of the simple solutions, and even more drastic solutions when it comes to lead in dirt. Karen, let's start with you. Yeah.
Well, there's also a public health issue in terms of soil, community-wide and city-wide, which is that we have Pittsburgh and Allegheny County has a lot of vacant lots, a lot of vacant properties where there were homes that were demolished. There could be a lot of lead contamination. And so the Allegheny County Conservation District and a lot of other partners are working together to sort of they're taking these soil samples and they're trying to sort of figure out where there might be lead hotspots. And they're also looking at research that suggests that dust from these lots or larger parcels of land could be kicked up in the summer, especially in the summertime when soil dries out, and that could be a public health problem for a larger group of people than just the people who are just confined to your own backyard.
So it's not just your backyard.
That's right. It could sort of spread. Exactly. There's a researcher in Indiana who's and others who've been working on this issue, and they're showing that blood levels in kids rise during the summertime, and that's not just because they're outside playing in the summer. It's because this dust kicks up, and it can be it can be go into your home. You can so it's a community-wide problem rather than just house by house.
All right, and Margaret, as far as lead in the water, some I don't want to say solutions, but remedies are as simple as filter all the way up to just plain replacing, right?
Sure. So not all filters are rated to remove lead. So filters that are rated to remove lead, a distribution of that within the next, hopefully they're finding someone to do that within the next 2 to 3 weeks. And then corrosion control. And the other thing is that the lead in the water is just one part of various threats to the system. Mayor Peduto said today in the public meeting that there are a half dozen areas in the system that if they fail, there is no backup plan. So there are significant threats, it seems, to the system that have to be addressed, not just lead.
Okay, 30 seconds. What are you going to continue to pursue when it comes to lead, Margaret?
Sure. I'm going to keep looking at any exception to the law that gets made at the state level, as well as funding and any restructuring of debt.
Kara?
Yeah, I want to look at what the laws are. For example, if you know that you have lead in your home or in your soil, you have to report that when you're selling your home. But it's a little tricky. If you don't know, you don't have to. There's some state legislation about soil testing before daycare centers are licensed. So I'm interested in looking at more of what's going on in a legislative level about protecting people.
Kara Holsoppel is host and producer of The Allegheny Front. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's Keystone Crossroads reporter. Thanks for your reporting. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up, we're going to discuss how the media covers diversity in our community. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Public Source has begun a series called I Am a Black Girl And, at least 10 stories of young African-American women in Pittsburgh and seeing the community through their eyes. We're going to talk about this project as a way to explore how the media covers or maybe fails to cover diversity in our region. Joining us in studio are Hallie Stockton, managing editor of Public Source. Good to have you here, Hallie.
Thanks for having me.
And Tori Parrish, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and president of the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation. Welcome, Tori.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Hallie, I'm going to start with you because we're going to use this series as our jumping off point. The impetus for the series, I Am a Black Girl And.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of a national coverage in a recent book specifically. I would say kind of compelled us to look into these issues more in depth, and that's Push Out by Monique Morris. She talks about the criminalization of Black girls starting in school, from, you know, disproportionate discipline, and how that snowballs into referrals to the juvenile justice system. We felt like we wanted to cover that. We wanted to look at our population of Black girls in the Pittsburgh region, but in a very comprehensive way. That's why in the project title, I Am a Black Girl And, that and is really important because it's not the same experience. And the whole time, you know, we talked with girls, they felt they were largely misrepresented. And so we wanted to make sure that we were talking about them in that multidimensional way. And not talking about them, but having them talk for themselves. And that is a major attribute of this project, that they are the ones managing this platform in a lot of ways.
I'm sure you're both familiar with, you were mentioning the book and the criminalization of young African-American women. There was a study that was released in the fall. I believe it was funded by the FISA Foundation and Heinz Endowments, and it focused a lot on African-American teens in the region, and it mentioned nationally, Black girls are referred to juvenile court. Here we go from the school to prison pipeline, three times as often versus white girls now, but that's national. Allegheny County, it's 11 times as often. And one more fact from that study, poverty as a sort of a conduit for entrance into the juvenile justice system. Nationally, nearly 40% of Black girls live in poverty. Pittsburgh, it's 55%. Those numbers are just startling, Tori, at least to me they are.
They are.
Maybe not to, I mean, I don't know.
They're not to me, but I know they are. I mean, I've seen those numbers before and read other studies, and they can be shocking to some people. I think that in some communities they face unique challenges that maybe some administrators might not be familiar with, and it might come as a shock to them. I think some kids, not all, so I'm speaking generally here, come from challenging neighborhoods, and some of those issues play out in school. You mentioned poverty,
right.
Hunger. If you're hungry, it's kind of hard for you to concentrate in school. What's going on home if, you know, both parents are working or one parent is working. So they're coming from some unique challenges when they enter the schools. And you don't just leave that at the door when you walk into the school.
Yeah, and you know, we actually took some of these statistics as a basis for the project. And I should note the FISA Foundation actually is a grant supporter of this project. So we took some of these statistics because we found that they were, you know, a little bit of what's been out there, but also by localizing it, it made it very personal. And we talked to some of the girls about this, and you know, they, when you're in it, they didn't always recognize it, but then, you know, they talked about some of these issues and what they see among their peers, and I think internalized a lot of this and got them really thinking about it.
So you talked about statistics, and I want to ask you how media covers those statistics or looks at those statistics. I mentioned about being referred to the juvenile justice system, just the rate of young African-American women versus young white women in Allegheny County. Do we focus too much on that? You know, they're in the juvenile justice system. They did something. They got into trouble versus what you were alluding to a little bit, Tori, the root causes of maybe why, and even the inequities of how blacks and whites are treated in terms of punishment or addressing some certain behavior.
Well, I think some neighborhoods do not get the coverage they deserve until there is something bad going on. And I'm speaking, I've been a reporter since 2003,
And I've worked in my hometown in Northern Virginia. I worked in Utica, New York, which is about 45 minutes from Syracuse. Worked at the Trib for 5 years. And for the last year, I've been on a Trib project called Upgroove, which is all online. And I do think that too often in communities, we don't show up until there's a crime and or until something's bad or until reports come from the state that school test scores are low, but we're not covering those communities on a regular basis. And so then when we try to go to those communities to cover whatever crime has happened, we get backlash because it never fails. People will say, well, where were you last week for the whatever good news event, or where were you for the elementary school graduation? You only show up here for what have you, you know, something negative. I think it's improving, but I think we have a long way to go. Okay. I think that we're more sensitive to that, but we still have a long way to go to improving that coverage.
And I think we, the media, often we focus too much on just what are the root causes and then stop. We need to be looking at the solutions, and it shouldn't just be a bunch of outsiders talking at them. What are the, these are, we are saying these are the solutions, but actually going to the communities and asking them, what do you think would help? And, you know, what can we provide to you that would help you make the solution? And so it's not always like parachuting in and, you know, pretending you're providing like the answer for everything. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's something that the all media can do a lot better.
Yeah. We're talking about how media covers diversity issues in our community, in the Pittsburgh community. And we are talking with Hallie Stockton. She is the managing editor of Public Source. And Tori Parrish is reporter for Pittsburgh Tribune Review and the president of the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation. Tori, your organization, Pittsburgh Black Media Federation, had a study last fall on diversity in the media. What stood out to you? Did you find anything shocking? Was it just this reinforced my thoughts, or was there something of surprise nature to you?
Well, we surveyed all media. Well, we sent surveys out to all media in the Pittsburgh region. Only print, only newspapers responded, and I think maybe some online. No broadcast media, including WESA, responded to the survey, and it was to survey diversity in your newsrooms, your management, women. It wasn't shocking to me because I've been doing this for a while. 10% of newsrooms in Pittsburgh, print newsrooms, newspapers, are Black. Compared to 20% Black people overall in Allegheny County and 35% in Pittsburgh. That doesn't include broadcast media, so it's probably worse, especially in management positions. And I think diversity is getting worse in Pittsburgh. You know, I have friends who've worked, you know, other media, people of women of color, and they left. Three left the PG within a matter of 6 months. So I think it's as resources shrink, and I think diversity is getting worse.
And that's our, if we're talking about root causes, that's our root cause for the problem in covering diverse communities in the media. How can we actually say that we can do that without a diverse workforce? Mm-hmm. You know, Public Source has this problem. We don't have much racial diversity. We don't have any racial diversity except for interns, which we're actively and intentionally working on that. And we just got funded a high school age Black female fellow for the summer for the first time in relation to this project. And we're hoping to make it permanent so that we can work on that pipeline of diverse journalists, show that it's a viable career path for them. But, you know, as it is now, we have gender diversity and we have age diversity, but that's it. And we need more in this community because these neighborhoods will continue to be misunderstood and not trust the media in any way if they don't see themselves represented on the staff or in the coverage.
Go ahead, Tori.
I'm sorry, she brings up a good point about mentorship and seeing images, seeing people who look like you. A lot of people or young people might not even think that this is a career option for them. I can't stress enough how important it is to see mentors and people who look like you. Whether you're going into journalism, you want to become a doctor, a lawyer, in some communities, if you're not seeing enough of that, you might think that that career is out of your reach. So I think that's very, very important.
I want to play a clip of an exchange from earlier this week, mm-hmm. between reporter April Ryan, American Urban Radio Network, and White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. About she started by asking a question about the White House trying to fix its image, and she was referencing Condoleezza Rice.
Comes Friday. Condi Rice did not support this president. She did not go to the convention. She comes. What is on the agenda, and how is their relationship? Has it healed since 2006 when he used a very negative word to describe?
So here's what I'll tell you. It's interesting that you ask those two questions back to back. On the one hand, you're saying, what are we doing to improve our image? And then here he is once again meeting somebody that hasn't been a big supporter of his. Hold on.
But
April, hold on. It seems like you're hell-bent on trying to make sure that whatever image you want to tell about this White House stays. Because at the end of the day, let me answer.
I am just reporting,
you know what? You're asking me a question, and I'm going to answer it, which is the president. I'm sorry. Please stop shaking your head again.
Now, the day after that, there was a little more cordial exchange in the daily White House briefing. In fact, Spicer called on reporter April Ryan for the first question. But to both you, and I want to start with Tori. So here is a young African-American, male or female, that might be interested in journalism, and they hear that. What do you think might be the reaction of, is this something I want to pursue? Or, yeah, this makes me really want to possibly get into the field of journalism. What do you think?
Well, I know it made a lot of working journalists mad, both, you know, across all racial backgrounds, both genders. I know it made a lot of people mad, and a lot of people rallied around April. I would hope that it would make people want to, I can only speak for what I think, but want to enter, because what he did was inappropriate. It doesn't matter if she shook her head until it rolled off her shoulders and out of the White House and into the Rose Garden. It's not the press secretary's job to discipline reporters. So it made me angry just watching that and listening to that. Like, really angry.
Were you angry?
I was thinking about it. I've been watching a lot of the Sean Spicer press briefings just out of curiosity. And I can't speak for how she felt in that moment, and that's what's most important. If she felt singled out for that, that's something that's inappropriate. But there also have been Sean Spicer acts inappropriate with a lot of reporters. And what was, I don't know if you guys recall this, when it was April Ryan who spoke up at Donald Trump's press conference weeks ago, and he was telling her to
set up
that meeting.
For the Congressional Black Caucus. Yeah.
Exactly.
Like she was the maid.
That was offensive to me. And because it was that, Tori, and it was also just that blatant lack of understanding of the role of media. And it's a plague on this administration that's a problem, but that was more offensive to me than this recent one. And I would hope, though, that if there are young people who see that, they would be emboldened by that and want to take these roles and take people like that to task.
In our remaining couple of minutes, I want to get to the big question of when we started talking about it, about making our newsrooms or having our newsrooms look more like our communities, but also so. That's the fair thing to do. It's the right thing to do. But it also, doesn't it also help form our coverage to get greater understanding of issues of diversity? Tori?
Absolutely. This conversation comes up all the time. Like, having a more diverse newsroom that reflects your community leads to better coverage. And having someone in the newsroom who is more sensitive to things that may be inappropriate or may not be presented in the best possible way. I'll bring up Tamir Rice, the way his father's criminal background was brought up, I believe, in Cincinnati. People had said, well, maybe if there were more people in the newsroom of people of color, not just Cincinnati, but everywhere, and people of color who could say, this is inappropriate, or you haven't covered this correctly, or get some more diverse voices besides the NAACP and the Urban League presidents. Get out into the communities and find some experts or just some regular community workers who can give you input and maybe give you some sources who you can interview.
And not just about issues of diversity or issues that are focused on the Black community. You know, issue like you were talking about lead issues earlier on the show. That's something that affects everybody of all racial backgrounds. And so there should be sources of different races on that too. It shouldn't just be like, okay, we're talking about diversity here, and so this is where we hit our quota of diverse sources. It needs to be spread throughout coverage.
Okay, I'm going to give the final word to Tori. 30 seconds we have, and that is this. Are you concerned that as newsrooms sort of shrink, as even some news organizations go away, that there'll be even less coverage of diversity issues?
Yes, I am concerned about that. That's why I really appreciate what Public Source is doing. I mean, they're a nonprofit, so they're doing stuff that organizations with much bigger budgets cannot do because they have to put their resources elsewhere with their Black Girls Project and covering lead issues. But I definitely think it's going to get worse. Just diversity is just shrinking all over the country.
Tori Parrish is Tribune Review reporter and president of the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation. Hallie Stockton is managing editor of Public Source. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Uber's self-driving cars return to Pittsburgh streets after being pulled for 72 hours. We're going to explore safety. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Uber's self-driving cars returned to Pittsburgh streets Monday afternoon, about 72 hours after the autonomous vehicles were pulled off the roads in Pittsburgh and two other cities where they're being tested, San Francisco and Tempe, Arizona, because of a crash in Tempe. We're going to talk about the safety of the vehicles, real and perceived, with Daniel Moore, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, covering technology issues. Welcome to the program, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Also in studio is Ryan Dito, Pittsburgh City Paper reporter who covers transportation. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
So the crash occurred in Tempe Friday. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, get us up to speed, if you would, on what the company and law enforcement said afterwards.
Sure. So this is a crash that happened, as you said, Friday night in Tempe, Arizona. It involved an Uber SUV that was strapped with autonomous technology. These are cars that are on the road not only in Pittsburgh since last September, but the San Francisco area and the Phoenix, Arizona area. And what had happened during this crash is local police said a car came up and failed to yield, and it struck the Uber SUV that was in self-driving mode. And in response to that crash, however, Uber pulled all of its test vehicles from the Pittsburgh area, from the San Francisco area, and from Tempe, Arizona. And so making that move was pretty remarkable because Uber has not encountered anything like this before. An Uber vehicle has not really been involved in a crash here in Pittsburgh. So that response was fairly remarkable to me.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's been some reports of some Uber cars, especially in San Francisco, is one that was recorded, running a red light. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's been any kind of, the car was turned over on its side. That seemed quite like a shock. So
right.
Daniel, I wanted to clarify and really emphasize something you said there. You say it was, amazing. It was not so much this is the first accident, but that Uber took this action. Is that what you're saying?
This is a company that's known for spurning local authority. It's known for aggressively pursuing this technology really at any cost so far. And for them to pull their cars off the road was really a signal. And, in fact, it earned praise from Mayor Peduto, who said, this shows that Uber cares about more than just profit. So they kind of earned the respect of local authorities with this one, even though an investigation revealed that the cars were not malfunctioning in any way.
Well, that's interesting because Mayor Peduto and Uber haven't been exactly the best of friends over at least, say, the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. So, Ryan, back to you, and it was mentioned about here in Pittsburgh, we have no reports. Do we have any indication that there are even any near collisions, something happened? Is there any data on that?
Well, the only data that I have is actually from this Bike Pittsburgh survey. And from this survey, there is instances of an Uber car passing by a cyclist just inches away, not within the 4 feet that is required by Pennsylvania law. Other than that, that's also anecdotal. So
Right.
I can actually say that a Uber autonomous car has actually passed me by less than the 4 feet. Definitely not inches, but, you know, less than the 4 feet before. But there's also no way of knowing whether that's the autonomous, you know, technology or if that's a driver taking over and, you know, passing by. But no, I have not heard of any kind of crash or big incident yet here in Pittsburgh.
Right. And, you know, it really, we learn about these accidents as they're reported, right?
Right.
And we do have a reporting issue here in Pennsylvania. Uber has to volunteer this data if it's not found by a local police department. So we found out about this crash in Tempe because the Tempe Police Department was looking into it, right? You know, I'm not a bicyclist, but I think I would feel comfortable next to a self-driving car, given that it would have a set response to a bicyclist. I think you noted in your story, the human drivers would have various responses to a bicyclist. They would go around them. They would scream profanities at them. Yeah. They would slow down and, you know, kind of hover behind them. Yeah. You know, I think that this would be an interesting thing if you could program the car to respond to bicyclists in a given way.
That's what I wanted to get to is, you know, they're gathering. I mean, the technology, let's face it, is amazing. At least it is to me. And the information they're gathering, let's face it, Uber is kind of secretive about the information and the data that they're a little bit reticent about sharing. And so I'm wondering, do we even know, can they gather? Do they have the ability to gather information about how close they're coming to a cyclist, whether it was 4 inches or, you know, less than the 4 feet?
Yeah.
Do they have that ability? Do we know?
No, we don't know because they won't share anything with with the public. Or they do have this Uber sharing thing that they put out there, and I actually signed up for it, but haven't gotten anything back. I don't actually know what the process is of how they, you know, give that data away, what they're giving away. I would think that since they have this like radar, LIDAR technology on the top of their car, that they would be able to tell just from the scientific standpoint, but I don't know. Like, you know, we don't know.
I would say that they definitely can tell. I mean, if their LIDAR is half as good as they say it is, they can determine whether something is a ball rolling across the street. They can probably tell whether it's a car door opening. They can tell whether it's a bicyclist in front of them. But as whether that data is going to be released anytime soon, it's anybody's guess.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the safety of autonomous vehicles, real and perceived, and we're doing that as a result of the accident in Tempe, Arizona, involving a self-driving vehicle, which was cleared by police in Arizona of any wrongdoing, any fault there. And we're talking with Daniel Moore, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Ryan Dito, reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. I want to get to what is required, what's not required. Pennsylvania does not have specific regulations overseeing the testing of autonomous vehicles. Is that correct?
That's true, yeah. And
there's
working
some legislation pending, though.
Yeah, they're working on it. And right now it's kind of like a patchwork of, you know, the federal government's working on something that would apply to all states. Pennsylvania's working on something. As of right now, they're largely relying on companies like Uber to report that data voluntarily, which so far has not really been happening. I mean, no self-driving venture wants to report every time they hit the brakes, every time they've got to slow down and go around something. So we haven't really seen that to date.
Yeah. I honestly can't imagine if Uber is ever going to do that. They, right. You know, they have a history.
Unless required.
Yeah, unless required, exactly. And it seems like the legislation's a little, I guess it's currently drafted, it's a little weak too. It's not just Uber too.
I mean, no self-driving venture would want to give up a lot of information to regulators on every time that they fail. You know, this is a really aggressive pursuit of this technology.
I think the legislative proposal under consideration right now would require a reporting of accidents and then just semi-annual reports on just the mileage and the time spent on the roads, and is that about it?
I believe that's true. I'm not super familiar with that. I know that California's regulations are a lot more stringent. They've got to report every time they hit the brakes, every time a human has to intervene in the vehicle. They've got to report that to California authorities, and I think Pennsylvania would be a lot weaker than that.
Well, you know, and speaking of that, there was a Recode article that, you know, was recently published that actually got some data somehow from Uber, and it actually showed that their drivers are taking over the autonomous vehicles in an average of every 0.8 miles. Mm-hmm. And that's that's in between their testings from, you know, all the areas. I would venture that that would probably be more often here in Pittsburgh because you don't really have those long stretches of straight roads that you would have like in Tempe, where you have these wide, very wide, straight roads because you're in the middle of the desert. Here we have hills, we have very narrow things. So you I would say that they would be taking over even more often than that.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons Uber came here in the first place is the challenging terrain, the weather, how dense the city is.
Potholes.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Pittsburgh left.
I don't know how you sense those.
I mean, I think all of us as journalists are waiting for that data to come out. I think we really want to be able to show what they're exactly doing. I think, you know, Uber's relationship here in Pittsburgh is really strange that they just don't want to be more forward with that because the relationship has soured basically between the administration and Uber now. And the mayor is even saying that we would have won the Smart Cities grant had Uber actually, you know, participated in it. And now we lost that $50 million to Columbus, Ohio. So it's, you know, whether or not that's true, you know, I guess we'll never know. But it shows that I think everybody wants Uber to participate a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to cite, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, human error is a factor in 94% of car crashes. Not surprisingly, recently there have been some surveys, some studies, and a few of them. And, Ryan, you alluded to one, the Bike Pittsburgh survey of cyclists and pedestrians, found that two-thirds of the respondents feel that self-driving cars will make roads safer. And I think you even alluded to why that perception is. Mm-hmm. But then there was a report, it was actually a little earlier in the month of March, AAA reported that 54% of drivers surveyed felt less safe sharing the road with autonomous vehicles, and 78% would be afraid to be a passenger in an autonomous car. So what's this come down to? Who you ask?
I think this gets at a lack of studies on what consumers want out of self-driving cars and consumer perception of self-driving cars. I think this is all too new for people to really grasp until you're next to one.
Honestly, I think we have to think about the power dynamics of how the roads are currently run right now. Drivers own the roads, like by far and away. Like pedestrians are probably next. Public transportation probably after that, and then cyclists are way at the bottom. And so it kind of makes sense for, you know, cyclists and pedestrians to be like, oh, yeah, let's change up the system with something that's going to take everything more equally, whereas drivers are like, is that driverless car going to stop at the right point? Is it going to do that? They like the system they have now because they have all the power. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I think we might have to think about when we think about those two contrasting surveys, you know?
All right, gentlemen, we have less than 2 minutes remaining. I want to get your thoughts on what is it that you as reporters are looking for? What's the next step that you want to take in your coverage of this issue of autonomous vehicles? Daniel, let's start with you.
I think it's getting more information and more data from the company. I mean, more reporting, whether that's Uber reporting to the city and us covering what the city's reaction is like, but really just this duality between the company and the city. Pittsburgh's given up a lot having Uber on its streets. And that's, you know, part of Peduto's frustration with Uber, I think, recently, that we've given up our streets. We've given up, you know, in theory, a lot of our safety. And what are we getting back for it? Are we getting any kind of data or information? Are we getting any assurances that this is really going to be safe? And I think that from my perspective, that's what we're interested in covering going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle on how to do this exactly, but I'd really, really interested to know what kind of impact we're talking about in terms of jobs. You know, what are we going to see? Uber's bottom line here is to try to take their taxi drivers off the road. They don't want to have drivers anymore so they can make more profit. What are we going to see in Uber? I mean, you know, in Pittsburgh, if that happens. And I think that'll be a really interesting dynamic. I think we have a lot more Lyft drivers, a lot more, you know, Uber drivers than, you know, we had before. So I think we need to really focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Dito, Pittsburgh City Paper, reporter who covers transportation. Daniel Moore is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He covers technology issues. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And finally, what's ahead? Baseball season. 1 week from today, the Pirates' home opener. There'll be a new pierogi in the pierogi races. After the fifth inning, it'll be Pizza Penny. She'll make her debut. She'll join Oliver Onion, Sauerkraut Saul, Cheese Chester, Jalapeno Hannah, and Bacon Burt. But only four pierogies will race at any one time. Go Cheese Chester. For this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.